Hello, this is Mary Ellen. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the New York Times, the November the 4th edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On page one, elections on Tuesday offered the Democrats a chance to get off the mat. Democrats have no federal contest that would allow them to check President Trump's power, but governor's races, mayoral contests, and referendums will test momentum and divisions in both parties. The article is by Shane Goldmacher. After more than 9 months of President Trump using the full force of the federal government to impose his will on the nation, elections across the country on Tuesday will offer the Democratic Party its biggest chance yet to assert its viability as a serious opposition party. No federal contest that could provide a meaningful check on Mr. Trump's powers in Washington will be decided. But races for governor in New Jersey and Virginia headline an election day that will provide a critical update on the state of the Democrats' rebuilding project and a preview of the fault lines in the 2026 midterm elections. The 2025 races have been buffeted by many of the same forces that shaped the 2024 race, led by an affordability crisis that is pinching voters in cities, suburbs, and rural areas alike. Unlike in the 2024 election, it is now Mr. Trump and his ambitious regime of tariffs that are seen as driving the economy. Ken Martin, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, predicted in an interview that victories on Tuesday would help his party head into 2026 with a head full of steam. Where there were once strong headwinds against the Democratic Party, there now seems to be wind at our back and momentum for sure, Mr. Martin said. He insisted, it's not just an anti-Trump wave that we're seeing, but a powerful chord that Democrats have struck with their message on economics and affordability. Of course, it helps Democrats that the biggest contests are being held in states that Mr. Trump lost. The flip side is that any defeats in those states could be especially deflating. Beyond the governor's races, mayoral contests in New York, Minneapolis, and Seattle will highlight generational and ideological divides in the Democratic Party. Supreme Court elections in Pennsylvania, a key swing state, offers a check on the main party's strength. Races further down the ticket, state legislative showdowns in Mississippi, a close attorney general contest in Virginia, two seats on Georgia's Public Service Commission, even a city council recall in Mesa, Arizona, will offer glimpses at the state of both parties in a time of division and rancor. In New York City, the rise of 34-year-old Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist who polls show is favored to win the mayor's race, has demonstrated the left's appetite to ingest fresh faces and new ideas into the fight. Mr. Mamdani faces a November rematch with former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's running as an independent after Mr. Mamdani's victory in the Democratic Party. Other consequential contests include a California ballot measure to redraw the state's congressional lines. The measure could squeeze as many as 5 House Republicans out of their seats and fortify a half dozen Democratic incumbents in an effort to offset restricting gambits by Republicans in Texas, North Carolina, Missouri, and potentially more states. Republicans hold a 3-seat majority in the House heading into the 2026 midterm elections, magnifying the importance of each seat carved off the battleground landscape by partisan mapmakers. Governor Gavin Newsom of California, the architect of the state's proposed new maps, held a bullish final rally in Los Angeles on Saturday, predicting Tuesday would be the beginning of a Democratic comeback. What this is all about is Democrats getting back on our toes, not our heels, getting our mojo back, Mr. Newsom said at the event where former Vice President Kamala Harris also appeared. I cannot wait for November 5th, November 6th, and all the punditry. The body language from top Republicans was far less optimistic. Mr. Trump himself has done little campaigning, including in the final weekend. He has held no rallies, instead speaking at recent telephone rallies aimed at New Jersey and Virginia voters. Mr. Trump's Justice Department has announced plans to send officials to monitor polling sites in six California and New Jersey counties, a tactic that Mr. Newsom has called an effort at voter intimidation and suppression, and even a pretext to later make false claims of fraud. The Trump Administration live updates, updated 20 minutes ago. Cities and nonprofits returned to court seeking full food stamp payments. Bessent plans to attend tariff arguments at the Supreme Court. And Trump advisors were paid over $1.6 million by the Albanian opposition. The elections are also unfolding against the unusual backdrop of the federal government shutdown, which will rank as the longest in American history by the time the polls close on Tuesday. Mr. Trump and congressional Democrats have barely engaged in negotiations, each side hoping a protracted fight will inflict more damage to the other. The fall's most contested and costly race, with more than $200 million in advertising, is for New Jersey's governorship. Jack Cittarelli, the Republican nominee, is making his third run in a row for the seat after narrowly losing 4 years ago to Governor Philip D. Murphy, a Democrat. He's urging voters to elect a Jersey guy and pressing to replicate Mr. Trump's strong showing in the state's Black and Latino communities. Representative Mikey Sherrill, who is the Democratic nominee and a former Navy pilot, has promised to declare a day one emergency to address rising utility costs in the state and blames Mr. Trump for the high cost of living. Mr. Cittarelli, in turn, has blamed Mr. Murphy and Democrats who dominate the state house for the state's struggles. Two historical and countervailing trends are converging in New Jersey. If Ms. Sherrill were to win, it would be the first time the state's voters have elected governors from the same party for three consecutive terms since the 1960s. At the same time, the state has often selected a new governor who counterbalances the party that occupies the White House, including both Mr. Murphy during Mr. Trump's first term and Governor Chris Christie during the first year of Barack Obama's presidency. The other top race is in Virginia, where Abigail Spanberger, the former congresswoman and CIA case officer, is favored to win the governor's mansion and replace the outgoing governor, Glenn Youngkin, a Republican. The Republican nominee, Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears, has never found her footing in a state that has been disproportionately affected, both by the government shutdown and the Trump administration's shedding of federal jobs. Though Mr. Trump never endorsed Ms. Earle Sears, the Spanberger campaign has barraged the airwaves with ads tying her to the president. Ms. Spanberger and Ms. Sherrill, who were roommates when serving in Congress together, are both moderate Democrats who were first elected in the Democratic wave of 2018, helping the party flip control of the House in Mr. Trump's first term. Some party strategists see their candidacies, even if they have not inspired the crowds and excitement of Mr. Mamdani's, as templates for how to take the House again in 2026. But Joe Gruters, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, downplayed the significance of the results, even if Democrats swept the governor's races on Tuesday. I don't think it has any indication whatsoever on the 2026 midterm, because these are both heavily blue states, Ms. Gruter said in an interview, praising Mr. Cittarelli's campaign in particular. I think the fact that we're competitive and are running close campaigns is an indication that we're better off. These are tough states for Republicans. The entire Virginia House of Delegates is also up for election this year, with the possibility that Ms. Spanberger won't just win the governor's mansion, but establish full Democratic control in the state. Virginia's most intense contest has proved to be the race for Attorney General between the incumbent Jason Meares and the Democratic nominee Jay Jones. The Jones campaign has been consumed by the disclosure of old private text messages in which the candidate wished violence on his political enemies. Mr. Jones has apologized, but the scandal has spilled into the governor's race, dominating Ms. Earle Sears' recent advertising. The race is expected to test the boundaries of ticket splitting in an era when it's become increasingly rare. Mr. Meares is expected to depend on winning over Spanberger voters to score re-election. Throughout 2025, Democrats have celebrated a string of either victories or better-than-expected performances in races in heavily Republican districts. But those were in obscure special elections where extremely few voters turned out. The races on Tuesday offer the party a chance to prove its competitiveness on a bigger canvas. The outcomes of low turnout elections held in so-called off years are far from predictive. Just 2 years ago, Democrats scored a slate of big victories: the Kentucky governorship, an abortion rights measure in Ohio, control of the Virginia legislature, only to lose the White House and Senate in 2024. Predictive or not, any party would far prefer victory over defeat. A win is a win, whether it's by one vote or 10 points or 20 points, Mr. Martin says. One overlooked but potentially consequential set of races is the retention elections for the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, where three Democratic justices must win approval to keep their seats and thus maintain the party's majority on the court in the nation's premier battleground through the next presidential election. Eugene DePasquale, who became chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party this year, said that success in the judicial contest would help lift the party's spirits after Democrats suffered serious defeats in 2020. Momentum matters, Mr. DePasquale said in an interview. We just have to start winning. The latest on the Trump administration. Redistricting push. President Trump is imploring lawmakers to redraw their congressional maps to stave off Democratic control of the House, but the debate over redistricting has revealed fissures within both parties. Test of the presidential power. The Supreme Court faces a so-called legitimacy dilemma as they deal with a tricky legal dispute over tariffs and a president who has made clear he would view defeat as a personal insult. And the Justice Department has told Congress that Trump could lawfully continue his lethal military strikes on people suspected of smuggling drugs at sea. The D.C. prosecutor's office in crisis. Few places have felt the effects of Trump's retribution campaign as palpably as the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, which is deeply enmeshed in the workings of government and has filed criminal cases against President Trump. Legal battle over foreign aid. Over nearly 9 months ago, the lawsuit challenging Trump's attempt to slash foreign aid funding has ricocheted around the federal judiciary, but still has not reached a final resolution. Ballroom donors. The administration has promised transparency about the funding of a new ballroom, but the White House withheld the identities of several donors to the project, including some with business before the administration, the New York Times found. A call to end a filibuster. Trump told GOP leaders to end the shutdown by eliminating the longstanding rule that means most Senate legislation needs 60 votes to pass. Here's more about the filibuster. How we report on the Trump administration. Hundreds of readers asked about our coverage of the president. Times editors and reporters responded to some of the most common questions. You asked, we answered. How the Times is reporting on the Trump administration. We invited readers of the New York Times to ask about our reporting on the second Trump administration, and hundreds responded. We read every question that came in, selected those that represented some of the most common themes, and then distributed them to editors and reporters responsible for our daily coverage of the administration. Here are their answers. Changes to White House coverage. How has covering the White House changed in the past few weeks? The executive branch and journalism surrounding it used to be such a well-oiled machine. How do Times journalists handle the chaos? The question is from Cameron Hughes, and it was answered by Richard W. Stevenson, the editor in charge of our reporting operation in Washington. You've no doubt heard of the president's flood the zone strategy. pump out so many developments on so many fronts that journalists will be overwhelmed and unable to focus properly on any of them. Certainly, this White House makes news almost constantly, 7 days a week, but we have enough reporters and editors to keep track of it all and present it to our audience with, we hope, the context and analysis necessary to make sense of it and separate substance from bluster and facts from falsehoods. Since the election, we've brought on new reporters and editors who give us additional capability. They include an expanded core of White House reporters and a new investigative team focused on how President Trump and Elon Musk are upending the federal government and driving policy in new directions. Given the sheer volume of news, we also strive to step back from the fire hose at regular intervals to try to sum up for readers what they need to know about a set of developments on a particular theme or in a specific period. For example, this piece by Luke Broadwater, one of our White House correspondents, explained how a particularly eventful stretch demonstrated how Mr. Trump was acting free of so many of the constraints that had kept him from pursuing his agenda and instinct during his first term. And the Times has a range of other formats that we use to help guide readers through the maelstrom, including our newsletters, our audio programs, and our video journalism. Hostility to the press. A free press is more important than ever under the Trump administration. What are the major challenges you face in carrying out that mission, and how do you meet them? Do you believe you can count on the full backing of your publisher? How does the New York Times resist the kind of pressure in which the Washington Post and the LA Times succumbed? Will the Times be censoring its work to avoid lawsuits and or imprisonment of their journalists? What rights do journalists have and who protects them? These questions are answered by Carolyn Ryan, one of the managing editors, the number two role in the newsroom. At the Times, our most important principle in our commitment to independent reporting. That means that we don't embrace a political party or a point of view, and it means we will cover the new administration aggressively, fairly, and comprehensively. That commitment is shared throughout the organization from the newest reporter all the way up to the publisher A.G. Sulzberger, whose family has stood for independent journalism for generations. You've probably heard about recent efforts by the White House and the Pentagon to limit access and exert more control over the press corps. We believe strongly that our readers and the broader public benefit from detailed reporting on our government's activities. We're fighting to have as much access and visibility as we can into this administration, and we'll resist efforts to block our access or undermine our reporting. Journalism is a constitutionally protected activity. Right now, journalists face intense pressures, threats, and harassment. We will not be intimidated in this climate and will continue to do what our readers most rely on us for, report without fear or favor. You're listening to a selection of articles on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is the New York Times, today's edition, November the 4th. Letters from Trump's first term. I'm curious about what lessons the Times journalists and the Times newsroom have broadly have learned from the way they covered the first Trump administration. Are there things that have changed on the level of editorial guidance? Are there any hard-won lessons for reporters? That question was asked by Morgan Spector of Hillsdale, New York, and answered by Richard W. Stevenson, the editor in charge of our reporting operations in Washington. The main lesson is to try and separate what some would call the Trump show, his ability to command attention, often by making norm-breaking or outrageous statements, from the concrete policy decisions and substantive changes in the direction of the country. The first requires some of our attention and a lot of contextualization and fact-checking, but also the discipline not to treat everything he says and does as inherently newsworthy. The second demands rigorous, open-minded journalism that explains what the changes are, what's driving them, who wins and loses, and what the ultimate impact is on the country. Just the first month of Mr. Trump's second term showed how determined he is this time around, not just to occupy the role of president, but to drive fundamental changes while also punishing perceived enemies, developments that we will cover from multiple angles. The editing process. Do reporters choose their stories or are they assigned? How many times is a story reviewed before it's printed? Do you have different levels of reviewers? For example, if you feel you'll get extra pushback from the government, is the article scrutinized more carefully? That question is from Sherry McDonald Miller from Vancouver, British Columbia. Answered by Mark Lacey, one of our managing editors, the number two role in the newsroom. The New York Times produces an excess of 100 stories a day. There's no single way they come into existence. In some cases, such as a significant news event, there's no doubt we'll be on it. We just mobilize. Many other stories are born out of suggestions by editors whose job it is to survey the world and look for opportunities. But a good portion of the stories we publish each day come from reporters themselves. They know their beats, they talk to sources every day, and they know the words. They talk to sources every day, and they know the words that make every editor's day. I found a great story. Now what happens when that story's filed? We give it at least two thorough edits before it's published. Particularly complex or sensitive stories will get additional eyes on them, often by senior editors who have developed expertise in various coverage areas. If a story relies on anonymous sources, it receives even more scrutiny. It's not without precedent for a single piece of journalism to be read by half a dozen editors or more. Our publishing system offers all of them to be in a story at once, offering queries off to the side. Only once all those questions are addressed, and we believe the story captures the complexities of what we're writing about, does one of us push the publish button. Calling out lies. Why does the Times not use words such as propaganda or lies more frequently when Trump / his staff are stating known untruths? It's clear that we're in a new era of propaganda. I would ask, how can the New York Times take more control of the language we use to discuss this disaster instead of letting Trump set the agenda by deferring to his terminology? Amy Burroughs asked that question from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Answered by Susan Wessling, the head of the Standards Department, which helps maintain the overall quality, accuracy, and fairness of our work. The newsroom of the Times has been reporting for years on Donald Trump's tenuous relationship with facts. We routinely point out falsehoods, exaggerations, and misstatements, making sure that we also then let the readers know what's accurate. We do that in news articles and also in more formal fact checks of speeches and other public events. That kind of accountability coverage, by the way, is not confined to Mr. Trump and the people in his orbit. Our obligation to the truth and to our readers means that we don't let false information go unchecked, regardless of the topic or source. So it's hard to argue that the Times is not letting readers know the full reality behind what Mr. Trump says, but we are cautious about describing a statement as an intentional lie or using our news report to effectively accuse someone of being a liar. We have robust discussions in individual cases when we think something is egregious enough to frequent enough to warrant the use of lie. And we have indeed used the word, but falsehood and false statements are not weak ways of assessing what Mr. Trump says. Trust in government data. Now that pauses have been invoked across many agencies and work the government does, how will we know if government reported data is vetted and accurate or twisted and compromised? How can the Times illuminate this, especially as we enter possible health crises or as we attempt to verify program success or failure? Obfuscation and muddy data counts can undo us. The question is from Jane McDonough in Hillsdale, New York. Answered by Jeremy Singervine and Rachel Shorey, editors specializing in data journalism. A core principle of data journalism is not to mindlessly trust data, no matter the source. When assessing data, we seek to understand how the data we use are collected, how they're processed, and what part of the real world they represent well or not so well. We speak to experts, read what others have written about a given data set, compare data sets to one another, and use shoe leather reporting techniques to probe their accuracy. The Times is keeping an eye on the quality of federal data under the new administration, given its plans to cut many government programs and overhaul others. As Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency seeks to gain access to more data systems, our reporters are asking sources about what effects this may have. Sometimes government data sets are so unreliable that those failings are news. As a case in point, Times journalists have reported extensively about the repeated and substantial errors in DOGE's wall of receipts. The Times also has been archiving many federal reports and data sets so that we can compare prior versions to new ones. In addition, several external organizations, including Harvard's Library Innovation Lab, are at work archiving federal government data sets. Keeping track of Trump's moves. Are you keeping a complete scorecard of Trump's orders and actions, the responses to them, and eventual outcomes from them? Questions from Ron Randall at Edgewater, New Jersey. It's answered by Hyun Park, a deputy editor in the graphics department. In February, we began a large effort to track every major move the administration is making. A team of journalists updates the page daily by reviewing the previous day's Washington coverage, presidential actions on whitehouse.gov, and Mr. Trump's social media feeds. There have been an average of about 11 actions every day. You can filter the list to show actions in a number of different categories. We are also keeping an eye on legal challenges to the administration's actions. We are tracking all the lawsuits against Mr. Trump's agenda here. We have also published a piece showing examples of Mr. Trump's actions that defy legal limits, as well as a legal guide to the president's moves so far. I love the Times' genius visual presentation, folks. This is the next question. I'd love the Times' genius visual presentation, folks, to keep some sort of diagram or infographic of all the parts of our government that are being stifled, gutted, defunded, or redirected. Good government is all often invisible. Make the harm more visible. The question is from EDE in New York City and answered by Hyun Park, a deputy editor in the graphics department. Every day we're working to break down the changes being made to the federal government in a digestible and meaningful way. We will be publishing more visual stories to explain the scale and impact of cuts. We started to keep a running tally of firings of federal workers. We're using a spreadsheet to track updates agency by agency, and we'll republish the page periodically as we confirm the numbers. We're looking at tangible impacts of the administration cuts. For example, one story showed how the administration's proposal to reduce grants for universities and hospitals could discourage medical research, including in areas like cancer and infectious diseases. Access to the administration. Do the reporters have a plan if Trump changes press briefings to limit sharing info on what he's doing? Are the Times folks picked to ask questions as much as other big papers that are Trump fans? The question is from Dorothy Wilson in Texas. Answered by Richard W. Stevenson, the editor in charge of our reporting operations in Washington. It's a common misconception that reporters rely heavily on White House press briefings as a source of news. While the briefings are useful in requiring the administration to face questions on the record and on camera, and sometimes do yield new information or insight, they're often an exercise in talking points. Our reporters attend because it's important to pose those questions, and they are called on regularly. But the vast majority of the work our journalists do takes place outside the briefing room and away from the cameras and involves regular contact with administration officials, presidential advisors, members of Congress, and other people involved in government and policy. One way in which the administration is different from its predecessors is that President Trump himself is far more accessible to reporters than was President Joe Biden, who rarely took questions or did sit-down interviews. Mr. Trump, of course, presents a different set of challenges, starting with the need to fact-check nearly everything he says. The role of the opinion section. I realize that you have fairness and impartiality foremost in mind as the New York Times. That said, what about a spin-off doing advocacy journalism? We want to do something, but what and how? Simply documenting the slow-motion train wreck of democracy seems inadequate. That question was from Henry Dedrick in San Antonio, and answered by Kathleen Kingsbury, the editor who oversees the Times opinion section, including its editorial board. The New York Times takes our commitment to independence seriously. Our newsroom pursues original, investigative, and fact-based reporting without fear or favor, seeking the truth wherever it may lead, and our opinion department elevates ideas, explores arguments, and challenges assumptions to enrich and enliven public discussion. Advocacy-based groups have their own valuable missions, but our mission as an independent news organization is incompatible with full-throated activism. Open-minded inquiry is at the heart of our mission, and being activists for a cause, however worthy or urgent, would undercut our role as a trusted source of independent journalism that serves a broad cross-section of readers, listeners, and viewers. Yet, Times Opinion is also unflinching in its effort to call out any institution, including the government, when our journalism surfaces illegal actions, lies, corruption, and immorality. This commitment is felt regardless of who is in power. We're unflinching in Times Opinion's mission to offer a breadth of perspectives that help people understand the forces shaping our world and to develop and challenge their own views. The columnist, editorial board, guest essays, and letters to the editor, as well as opinions, newsletters, audio, video, graphics, and design, bring trusted signature voices and strongly edited, face-backed commentary to the major questions of the day on democracy, war, technology, climate, the way we live now. We do this while not explicitly advocating on behalf of any specific group of or people on an institutional level. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. I'm reading from the New York Times, today's issue, November the 4th. Immigration raids. I'm wondering if you are closely following what's happening locally with raids on immigrants. The question is from Heather Ash in Decatur, Georgia, answered by Anna Lay, a reporter who covers immigration in New York City. We spend a lot of time searching for clues in places such as police reports and social media platforms, and we frequently call people who are in a position to know whether raids are happening, such as immigrants themselves and their neighbors. These sources can also include members of law enforcement, immigration lawyers, or advocates for immigration communities. Our newsroom also pays for services that help us detect emergencies such as mass arrest or spikes in law enforcement activity. As you can imagine, we encounter a lot of false alarms and misinformation. Many of the posts we see online about raids lack context and crucial information, such as the size of groups that are detained and deported. And what some observers have described as raids have turned out to be routine small-scale arrests. Once we have a solid lead about the potential raid, we go to people with direct knowledge to confirm whether the information is accurate or not. In New York City, which has the largest immigrant population in the country, there has been no credible proof of any large-scale immigrant detentions other than a highly publicized crackdown in late January that yielded 39 arrests. Even so, many immigrants tell us that they are terrified about being caught in a dragnet, especially in heavily Latino communities, and legal aid groups are ramping up efforts to inform immigrants of their rights. Environmental coverage. What connections, relationships do you have with trusted, respected scientists and others who can speak to the impact of Trump's environmental policy changes? The questions from Valerie Beeman in the San Francisco Bay Area, answered by Raymond Zong, a reporter on the climate team. For decades, scientists have driven the global conversation about climate change and what to do about it, which is why their expertise has long informed the Times' climate and environmental coverage. Researchers do not lock themselves away in ivory towers, as people sometimes imagine. Many of them actively follow policy changes and try to inform the public in a timely way about what they mean for our planet. My fellow climate reporters and I constantly talk to researchers and infuse their findings into our coverage. How do we decide what experts to speak with? Science, unlike many human endeavors, is largely conducted out in the open. Researchers publish their results for everyone to see and scrutinize. As a climate science reporter, I spend a lot of time keeping up with scholarly journals. I read new studies, each of which has a bibliography that leads me to more studies. By perusing the academic literature, you can get a pretty good sense of which scientists are influential in their field, who has made interesting discoveries, and who's well respected by their peers. Something else that helps us make sure we're talking to credible researchers, the top science journals generally require the authors of every study to disclose potential conflicts of interest. Effects of tariffs. Will you please run articles which plainly explain how tariffs affect prices and pocketbooks of consumers? It would be nice if these articles could be read by people who aren't economists or tax professionals. Mary Moore in Maryland. Answered by editors on the Trust Team, which helps maintain the overall quality of our work. President Trump's tariffs are a complex subject, and our journalists strive to explain their ramification in ways that readers can understand. A good place to start is our graphical explainer on how tariffs work. We also broke down the automotive supply chain to illustrate how multiple countries contribute to the production of a single vehicle. Rebecca Elliott, a reporter who covers energy, visited the largest oil refinery in the Midwest, which depends on heavy crude from Canada. It could be forced by tariffs to cut back its production of gasoline and airplane fuel, which would lead to an increase in prices. Another one of our reporters talked to small business owners who warned that tariffs on Chinese-made goods would be passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices. We have reported that the economy is already starting to show signs of strain as the fear of trade wars combines with federal funding freezes and mass firings to sour consumer sentiment and stall business investment. Some readers told us they were already stockpiling goods for fear of rising prices. Overall, polling suggests a mixed view of tariffs among Americans. Rhonda Kaysen, one of our real estate reporters, talked to developers who said the tariff threat had created instability in the price of materials, which could drive up housing costs. Even the price of happy hour could be affected. A reporter in Brussels, Gianna Smialik, described a long-running game of tit-for-tat tariffs on spirits from the European Union and the United States. The president has argued that this turmoil will pay off in the long run. On the Daily podcast, our economics reporter, Anna Swanson, interviewed Mr. Trump's trade advisor, Pete Navarro, who believes tariffs will usher in a new age of American prosperity. Ms. Swanson also wrote about Mr. Trump's ambition to strike a wide-ranging trade deal with China's leader, Xi Jinping, that would result in more American exports to China. To better understand the big picture on Mr. Trump's tariffs, you should also read this analysis by our global economics reporter, Peter S. Goodman. Trump on the homepage. Please find a way to isolate Trump news to its own category or page so us subscribers don't have to be exposed as much as he would like. Trump plays the press like a fiddle. I, like many, have to limit my intake to keep sane and have terminated subscriptions to do so. I'm still keeping the New York Times for now, but would like to see more effort from the Times not to play into his hands so much. That is from C.M. Huska in Bend, Oregon, answered by Karen Skog, an assistant managing editor who oversees home screen programming. The top of our home screen reflects the stories the Times believes are the most important. Our newsroom leadership team, referred to as the masthead, discusses each day's priorities with other editors from across the newsroom, and these days President Trump typically dominates those conversations. The Times is committed to covering all aspects of Mr. Trump and his administration, and we aim not just to recount the news, but also to provide analysis and context to help readers understand what it all means. We think about packaging Trump stories thematically on our home screen. You might see a group of stories about his economic moves, a collection about his foreign policy, and another about deconstructing the federal government. We try to keep those packages tight. If you want to read every word, you can dive in. If you'd rather read about something else, you can scroll past. We program our home screen with a wide selection of stories and visuals to appeal to all types of readers. We always offer news from around the world and around the country, stories that engage readers on a variety of topics, like The Great Read, journalism that helps you live a better life, like our Well coverage, or pieces that often offer specific guidance like recipes or shopping advice. And in the app, we have even more room to showcase the breadth of our journalism. A ribbon across the top lets you scroll to find lifestyle coverage, sports, opinion pieces, and more. We're always looking for the best balance and mix for the home screen and thinking about the best ways to get our journalism in front of readers. Public reaction to Trump. How are you reporting on the consequences of Trump's decisions? For example, freezing federal grants could harm communities that rely on them. Hearing directly from those affected would provide valuable insight. In particular, interviews with Trump supporters who are directly impacted by his policies would be especially compelling. It would shed light on their perspectives and whether their views on his administration shift as a result. That question is from Aaron Basis at Rochelle Park, New Jersey. The second question is, I'd like to hear from people who agree with Trump's decisions also and why. We all crave media that tells the objective truth about the issues instead of telling only negative reports about the decisions they personally disagree with or positive reports about the decisions they agree with. We crave the truth. This from Christine McCurdy of Mount Rainier, Washington. The Times has made it a priority to put reporters on the ground talking to Americans about President Trump's actions and how their local communities are being affected. Kellen Browning, one of our political reporters, found guarded optimism among Trump supporters in one Arizona swing district. We sought out the opinions of Black voters and asked people what they think of Elon Musk. Another reporter attended a town hall meeting in rural Texas where a Republican member of Congress was confronted by angry constituents. We met government workers and federal contractors struggling to pay their bills after being abruptly laid off, and interviewed dozens of American farmers about how funding freezes have affected their business. Eduardo Medina and Emily Cochran, two of our reporters who cover the South, found both anxiety and optimism in Huntsville, Alabama, about the future. They're concerned about the future of the aerospace industry, which depends heavily on federal funding and workers. We ran the numbers on how proposed reductions in funding for medical research would hit colleges and hospitals in every state, and reported on concerns that the country will be more exposed to catastrophic wildfires and other natural disasters after layoffs at the U.S. Forest Service and the virtual elimination of an office that coordinates disaster recovery efforts. Our reporters continue to seek out views from a diverse array of Americans and explore the effects of a dizzying series of policy changes emerging from this administration. Threats to reporters. How do journalists feel about their job security and fear of retaliation when reporting on the Trump administration? As we have seen the president retaliate against people that he's identified as those who have crossed him, how do journalists handle death threats, and how often have they received them for specifically writing about Trump? That question is from E. Sykes in Seattle, answered by Jason Reich, the Vice President of Safety and Security for the New York Times. The profession of journalism always comes with risk. Reporting is done best when journalists move within a culture they're covering and talk directly to people with lived experiences and firsthand knowledge of events, wherever that might be in the world. Perfect security would mean not being able to do any of these things. But clearly, risks increase as reporters and their news outlets are more prominent, more out in the world, and engaging with people who have hostility or resistance to independent media. Unfortunately, Times reporters covering politics and governments do face threats from time to time. This includes online harassment, threatening and hateful letters and emails, physical intimidation while in the field reporting, and in rare cases, more serious threats. Our security and legal teams are among the best in the industry, skilled groups of professionals who ensure that our journalists can be at the forward edge of coverage and that our journalism is published with confidence and surety. Threats against journalists are concerning, and our company strives to show the value of independent journalism for the good of society. Despite escalating anti-press rhetoric in the country, our reporters tell us they have confidence and zero hesitation in the work that they do. Paying for news. Does the Times have some kind of strategy for making Trump-related news available to people who do not subscribe? Many people probably can't afford the New York Times and aren't able to access the valuable information here as a result. They only access free news outlets and social media sites that are full of misinformation and propaganda. This question was answered by Danielle Rhodes Ha, Senior Vice President and Head of External Communications for the New York Times Company. Subscribers make our journalism possible. Our newsroom sends journalists to report on the ground from 160 countries. Independent and original reporting is expensive to produce. For example, we provide protection for reporters in war zones and other physical and digital security measures for our journalists, as my colleague Jason Reich shared in the previous answer. We currently have the largest team we've ever had covering the new administration. We couldn't do this without subscriptions, which make up a majority of the Times' revenue. That said, our news reporting is viewed tens of millions of times each week, and we make a significant amount of our journalism available to anyone not ready or able to subscribe. Our homepage, the morning email newsletter, and the daily podcast deliver headlines and daily summaries to anyone at no cost. Editing Trump's quotes. Are quotes by the president printed as presented, or are they edited, if some have claimed the Times does? Please quote exactly as stated and then offer analysis / paraphrasing if the quote requires further explanation. From Connie Guillermo in San Francisco Bay Area. answered by Mike Abrams, the deputy editor on the standards team, which helps maintain the overall quality, accuracy, and the fairness of our work. The Times has clear rules about quotations. We believe that readers have a right to assume that every word between quotation marks is what the speaker said. We don't clean up quotations. If a statement is hard to follow, we recommend paraphrasing it for the sake of clarity. When the president or anyone else says something confusing, it's our job to press for an explanation. When we can't get clarity on deadline, we should share what we know and don't know in the coverage. There are cases where the very confusing wording is part of the story. Perhaps it is a social post by the president. Our style book instructs reporters and editors to render such material faithfully. We want readers to see that language just as they would find it on social platforms like X or Truth Social. There are times when we impose our style rules on spoken quotes and statements. For example, we abbreviate state names after cities and use the dollar sign for references to money instead of the word dollars. The idea is to provide consistency for readers. If we learn that we quoted someone or something inaccurately, we will fix the passage and append a correction to the article. President Trump or Mr. Trump? Why do you keep referring to the president as Mr. Trump instead of President Trump? The Times has not done this with previous sitting presidents. Answered by Mike Abrams, a deputy editor on the standards team, which helps maintain the overall quality, accuracy, and fairness of our work. We get this accusation every time the White House changes hands, but it is simply not true. The Times has referred to the president in the same way dating back at least to Abraham Lincoln. He's always President Trump the first time he's mentioned in an article. On subsequent references, to avoid repetition, reporters may also use the president or Mr. Trump. This was the case for Mr. Biden, Mr. Obama, Mr. Bush, Mr. Clinton. The courtesy title, as we call it, Mr., Mrs., Mrs., Ms., Dr., is used throughout the Times, with some exceptions, including coverage of culture and sports in publications like the New York Times Magazine. God. A version of these articles appeared in print on March 17th in the New York edition with the headline, Your Questions on Our Coverage of Trump Answered, Part 2. This is from the opinion page, guest essay from the New York Times, November the 4th. Trump's Great Gatsby Party did not accept SNAP. The author of the article is Molly Jong Fast. She's a guest opinion writer. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, a book that you were probably required to read in high school, but that makes much more sense when you go back and read it again as an adult. That's especially true if you've been banged around enough by life to understand that the glamorous, elusive, self-invented party boy Jay Gatsby was not, in fact, someone you should aspire to be. He was not the hero. Also, it ended quite badly for him. Donald Trump was clearly not much of a reader, so maybe it wasn't that surprising, and it's also just too perfect, of course, that on October 31st, with the federal government still shut down and SNAP benefits about to be disrupted, leaving about 42 million Americans without money they were counting on to eat, he was hosting a Great Gatsby theme party at Mar-a-Lago. It was one of those sticky images of Mr. Trump, the most powerful man in the world, surrounded by a cavalcade of activity, the curve of a white feather poking out from a floral centerpiece, the blur of candles and candelabras and waiters in black vest, affixed with royal-style crest. Next to the crest were bronze name tags that protruded awkwardly. Next to Mr. Trump was his multi-hyphenate Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. In a photo, one could make out a smile and a bit of a laugh coming from Mr. Rubio's mouth. Next to him was a woman in a 1920s-style headband who was looking out at the wide, lush expanse of Palm Beach. The story of the rise and fall of the self-made semi-criminal Jay Gatsby takes place in the summer of 1922 during the presidency of Warren G. Harding, who is remembered for the Teapot Dome bribery scandal, although all manner of corrupt things went down during his terms. The year before Gatsby was published, strict immigration quotas went into effect that drastically restricted the number of Southern Europeans and Jews allowed into the United States, as neither of those groups was at the time considered white by the WASP establishment of the era, tipsing on their own replacement theory fears. The 1920s were a time of extraordinary wealth creation and remarkably lax regulation. It's hard imagining that Gatsby and those who partied at his house every night would have missed out on the kind of get-rich scheme of the crypto and AI booms had they existed back then. It's just as hard to imagine that our current roaring 20s is going to end any better than theirs ultimately, did in October of 1929. In present-day America, there are signs of a stock market bubble. Food pantries are already strained. Inequality is rampant. The top 10% of U.S. households now make up nearly half of all spending, the highest level since the 1980s. Many large companies aren't hiring. More Americans are falling behind on their car payments. And health insurance rates are expected to increase for millions of Americans, a major reason that we have a government shutdown in the first place. But the shutdown accurately reflects the administration's priorities. The big, beautiful bill, which continues the tax credits from Mr. Trump's first administration, and makes cuts to Medicaid. Americans aren't happy about it. 4 months after the signature policy bill was passed into law, according to polling, they say two-thirds of Americans say that the country is pretty seriously off on the wrong track. Mr. Trump successfully rode previous unhappiness to election twice on promises of draining the swamp, fixing a rigged system, and he often did a shtick on the campaign trail that he called the weave about the price of bacon. Mr. Trump has whipped up populist frenzy, but has had little interest in enacting populist legislation. Instead, he hired the richest man in the world, a notably uncharitable billionaire Elon Musk, to make the government more efficient, including cutting grants to the National Institute of Health for Cancer Research, firing a broad swath of federal employees, many of whom needed to be rehired, and according to one estimate, costing taxpayers millions of dollars. The article is in the opinion page of the New York Times. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 4th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Mary Ellen. Thank you for listening.